You know him.
He's unfortunate.
He's Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix.
Podcast Go.
And this is the Crossover NBA Show.
This guy is a freaking joke.
Hey, hey, hey. He's here to break down the league.
Nah, he's inaccurate.
That's probably true.
That's fair.
But make a game of it. Just take a drink every time Mannix says,
I was dead wrong.
See? I'm solving problems. Now here's your host.
These guys are going to run me into the ground.
Chris Mannix.
All right, welcome back. Crossover NBA podcast. Glad you could join me this week in a very strange week in the NBA. You certainly have things going on off the court or on the court. Off the court, all the talk right now is about the coronavirus and the impact it's going to have on the NBA for the rest of the season and into the playoffs. Talk about that and maybe some other fun things along the way, like the MVP race. Howard Beck, senior writer over at Bleacher Report, has his own podcast, The Full 48, which he records from a nicer locale than we're doing right now in Midtown Manhattan at an empty restaurant inside a hotel there. Right, Howard?
Yeah, no, it's good amid this time of social distancing and the need to insulate ourselves from viruses that are easily transmitted that we are basically in the heart of Times Square. So great choice of location, Chris. You really hit it right on the nose.
Just flying right into the teeth of coronavirus. All right, so let's connect it to the NBA. As we record this on Wednesday in the morning, the NBA has not announced cancellations of any games. They have not decided to have games played with no fans on the floor. They're certainly considering it, Howard. The people that I've talked to have said effectively all options are on the table. So they're being diligent about all this. But where do you see where we are in this situation? And where do you think we're headed with the coronavirus as how it relates to the NBA?
Well, we may know more soon because the Board of Governors is meeting, I don't think in person, but virtually today. They're going to have a conference call. And so by the time this podcast is published, by the time you all are listening, we may have some clarity. But trying to guess where it's going is difficult because, as we've all seen, like minute to minute, day to day, this thing is changing, and not just with the NBA, but all around the country, all around the world. And when you see things as dramatic as the entire nation of Italy shutting down, then you cannot rule out anything. The Chicago St. Patrick's Day parade, which is a really big deal in Chicago, was just called off this morning. And
same thing in Boston too.
Yeah. So, and we've seen conference tournaments called off. The Ivy League, the NBA. It seems like they're trying the path of least resistance or the path of least business damage so far. You know, it's hard. Listen, we all fully understand what the league was doing with regard to the locker rooms, closing it to the media. It's a small inconvenience for us. That's fine. Under the circumstances, we all accept that this is something that feels necessary. But and there are reasons that are unique to the locker room that we could get into. But it is hard, Chris, to see that and then watch last night as Bradley Beal comes off the court at the end of the game, high fives a young fan, like a 7-year-old boy, and then puts his arm around him and takes a selfie, to think, well, where's the consistency here? Who are we protecting? How is this actually, where's the logic and the consistency here? And when you've got 20,000 people in an arena, including seats that fans buy right next to the benches, is this really the best way of containing an outbreak? And that's the whole thing right now. It's about containment, and it's about trying to keep this phrase that we will all now learn and know for the rest of our lives, social distancing. And if you take it to its logical next step, Chris, I think we are heading toward games with no fans in the building. I think that is it to me, it feels inevitable. And when you see that certain locales, you know, Santa Clara County in California, Seattle. This is a really interesting what if. The governor of Washington has declared certain counties should not have gatherings of more than, I think, 250 people. So basically all concerts and sporting events of any size. If the Sonics were still in Seattle, the NBA would be having a massive trigger point right now about, well, if Seattle can't play and we can't send teams there, do we relocate the Sonics temporarily? I don't know, let's say to Oklahoma City. And then figure out how to play games, and then how many other teams does that affect? Can we just move one team for the time being? Or if that's shut down, is that the trigger to shut down all 30 or to play games with no fans? Mm. I don't know, but it's a really interesting. My apologies to Seattle fans who are going through PTSD every time it's brought up. But like, if Seattle still had a team right now, this would be a different discussion at this very moment, because that's the first place where they've really said, by all, there's no way this is going on. Other places have been like an advisory. We would prefer not to. I believe in Washington State, I believe that's an order.
Mm. Yeah, I agree with everything you said there. I do think we are headed towards playing games in empty arenas or potentially cancellation of games at some point this season. I think San Francisco is right there. You know, they're talking to the Warriors about what they should do moving forward, because that's emerged as a potential hotspot in Northern California. I know the governor of Ohio has suggested that effectively the Cavaliers don't play home games. Now the Cavs, I believe, are on, they started a West Coast road trip or some kind of road trips. They're on the road till middle or end of March, so they have a little bit of time. But you know, they might be one of the first ones, Howard, where they say, you know, because the governor has advised this, we got to not do it. And look, as much as anyone, I would not want to see games get canceled, but I would understand it. I mean, what the NBA's done with the media certainly protects the players a little bit more. I'm not sure how much, but it protects the players a little bit more. What they have done with what they're looking at, what they haven't done yet, is protect the fans in a certain way.
Yeah.
You know, you've got 18,000 fans in an arena. You're not really protecting them at all. So if people are coughing on each other or exchanging high fives, not out of the realm of possibility in those situations, it's problematic. So I think they're, at some point, they're going to have to start worrying about the fan base and not just about the players.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Your greater social responsibility, your civic responsibility as a business, as a league, is to look out for everyone. And right now, I don't want to this to come off as too callous or to say that the league is being callous, but the league's initial response here is really more about protecting the NBA. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to say otherwise. Listen, Pearl Jam just postponed their tour because they thought, we don't want our fans gathering in these arenas and possibly infecting each other. So we're just calling off the tour for now. And we've seen other measures like that where things have been postponed. You know, Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders decided not to have rallies
In Ohio,
on a day of all these critical primaries. Like, that's a staple of the political scene, right? You get your supporters together, and you have a rally. That's what you do. They called it off out of an abundance of caution, because not worried about their own exposure, because the wise thing is to not have a bunch of people, thousands of people potentially, gathering in a small space or a limited space. So what the NBA has done so far is really about protecting the players and not having to have quarantines of their own, right? A single player gets infected, the cascading effect of that could be pretty dramatic. Mm. And so, all right, that's fine. That's a fine initial step. But at what point does the NBA decide to make policy decisions that are more about the broader concern of spread of the virus across society, as opposed to just what affects the NBA?
And if you want to look at just their bottom line in all this, if one player gets affected or is affected, you have to quarantine the whole team, don't you? I mean, isn't that kind of how it works this point?
If one player came up positive for coronavirus.
Which, by the way, I talked to a lot of NBA trainers, medical staff people. To a man, they've all said, we believe it's going to happen.
Yeah.
We believe there will be a player that gets this.
It feels like statistically, you know, it'd be almost impossible that it doesn't happen, right? It'd be a miracle if it didn't happen among 450 players, all of whom have their own routines and kids who are in schools where they may be getting exposed. And, I mean, listen, we're all doing our best to wash our hands and Purell everything and
elbow bump each other, as you and I did on the way in.
Yeah, I mean, we're all doing what we can, but I mean, you know, stuff's still gonna happen. Guys are gonna slip up. You're gonna, a loved one is gonna accidentally get infected, and then it's gonna infect the player.
Like, a family member off the court has it. They take that person's home. The player brings it into the locker room. Like, there's a cascading effect to all this.
So what? Here's the potential of what could happen, and why the NBA is so sensitive to keeping us out of the locker room, where we are then converging in very tight spaces on the players and on each other. if one player tests positive for coronavirus, yeah, you're going to have to quarantine not just him, but probably the whole team. But then if they played the night before, well, okay, that team's going to have to be quarantined too. But what if it was two nights before and that other team had a back-to-back? Well, now there's a third team involved.
You don't show symptoms for, you know, 5 to 10 days or something like that.
And there's a lot of voluntary quarantining going on right now here and around the world, where if you were exposed, the prudent thing to do is to sequester yourself for a couple weeks till you're no longer a threat to pass it along. And so if the NBA were to take that kind of approach, one single player testing positive, the domino effect could mean multiple teams having to self-quarantine, and the next thing you know, you're just not having any games, and you are ripping out parts of the schedule. And again, that's on the table too.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't think we're going to have much of a choice at some point. I think it's going to eventually happen. And I know the NBA, there were people in the NBA office, when Indian Wells got canceled, that resonated with a lot of people, that a major tennis tournament would be shut down because of this. And you also had some, you know, social entertainment stuff canceled. South by Southwest and other events were canceled or postponed. But, I mean, a sporting event like Indian Wells, I think that resonated with the league. So I think we're probably headed in that direction. The question really only becomes how long does stuff like that – because you mentioned Italy, Italy's a big-time problem. They've, like, you don't want it to get to that point where you have to shut down an entire country. You can say it's not as big a problem in the U.S., but I'm sure at some point Italy said the exact same thing.
Well, and we're behind the curve because the testing wasn't there and because people were sleeping on this and trying to downplay it and not being aggressive in dealing with it. And so we are behind the curve statistically. And look, I'm not an expert on this, clearly, but I've been reading enough to know, like, the possibility that there are way more infections out there, that it's spread way further than we know because of the lack of testing early on and because of how long it took before we really started to make any kind of policy decisions to deal with it. Yeah, this thing could explode exponentially very quickly. And maybe it won't. Hopefully it won't. But that's what everybody has to weigh. And I think there's almost like a peer pressure among all these entertainment entities, whether you're a concert promoter or a sports league or a conference, where, yeah, when Coachella shuts down, when South by Southwest shuts down, when Indian Wells shuts down, then people are looking to the NBA going, okay, guys, these other, you know, outlets, these other entities that have mass gatherings decided it was not prudent to have mass gatherings. What about yours that go on every night with 20,000 people in an arena in multiple cities at a time? There's going to be a pressure there and to do the right thing. And it's a difficult thing to do, whether it's not playing games or playing games with no fans in the building. But, you know, listen, we all praise the NBA for being progressive and civic-minded, socially conscious, and for, you know, and for trying to do the right thing on a number of levels, and that praise is earned for a number of reasons. This is a little bit different than any other challenge they've had to face. I am very curious to see how they decide this.
We all know you're a big Coachella guy, of course. You know, that was a bitter disappointment for you. And you know, by the way, the people that are kind of overly glib about this, to say it's not a big deal, a 3% mortality rate is a real thing, so you all can fuck right off.
Like, yes.
That's, to me, is...
If you're downplaying this, there's something wrong with you.
We've all got parents. We all know people in their 70s and 80s who are literally having their life threatened as we speak by something that's spreading incredibly rapidly across this country. So, you know, forget about all that. Let's talk a couple things about basketball. Last week, really this week, Kenny Atkinson let go by the Brooklyn Nets. Atkinson was a phenomenal coach for them for a number of years, took them from a 20-win team when he first took over into a 42-win playoff team. Tremendous player development coach, arguably the best player development coach in basketball. Maybe him and, I guess, Nick Nurse and the staff up in Toronto go head-to-head. You look at the young players they've developed, not even blue-chip guys, Caris LeVert, Spencer Dinwiddie, Jared Allen, Joe Harris. I mean, the list goes on of good players. And three-quarters of the way through, you know, this season, his first with Kyrie Irving, his first with a more veteran roster, if you include Kevin Durant in the mix, suddenly Kenny Atkinson-Howard is gone. And the message that was sent via the Nets, via Sean Marks, was that it was a mutual decision that Kenny said, and this is Sean Marks' words, that my voice is no longer resonating in the locker room. What do you make of all that? Kenny Atkinson being gone and the explanation for how Kenny Atkinson is gone?
I think there's a lot we don't know yet, as is often the case in these situations. I think we will probably learn more as the weeks and months go on, as is often the case in these situations. From what we know right now, or what we think we know, and from what's being whispered, it certainly sounds like there was a divide and some tension there between Kenny Atkinson and the locker room. Now, how much of the locker room? Which parts of the locker room? How much is this about the stars, neither of whom are playing right now, one of whom, Kevin Durant, hasn't played at all, obviously, and Kyrie's barely been a blip this season? That stuff is still, I think, a little murky. There's a lot of suggestion out there, but I am hesitant to go pin it on the easy, oh, the stars overthrew the coach kind of thing. I think there was probably a bit of a divide there, and I don't dismiss the idea that like, when they say mutual, I think this was a team decision. Let's be clear on that. From what I know, I'm not certain that Kenny Atkinson would have fought that decision that hard. Now, whether he actually went to them and said, you know what, it's time, let's all just mutually part ways. I mean, I don't know what the percentage divide is between Kenny versus the team on this. I do think that there is some recognition, from what I'm gathering, that Kenny knew it was going to be an uphill battle, and especially next season when they've got a full team. It's unfortunate on so many levels, because we all rightfully praise this team for the culture that they built, and that's partially Sean Marks, and that's a lot of Kenny Atkinson. And you named all the players who improved on his watch, who developed on his watch, guys who were dismissed and thrown in the dumpster by other teams, and Joe Harris and Spencer Dinwiddie, that had been given up on. And then guys like Jared Allen and Caris LeVert, who were later first-round picks, who did not have high expectations coming in. And like, his track record with that team over the last several years is fantastic. And Kenny will get another great job somewhere. But, I've said this on my own podcast yesterday when I was talking to David Thorpe. Like, we know there's no fairness in the NBA, right? There's no somebody deserved this or without a fairness. It doesn't work that way, right? It's the NBA, and it's a tough business. But do I think on some level Kenny Atkinson earned the right to have the full team and to get to have a chance to coach Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving and the rest of that group together and see what he could do with it? Yeah. Like, right now, he's the guy who was the development coach who got his first crack at a head coaching gig, overachieved year after year after year. And now the question's going to be, well, maybe he's not a championship coach. He's better off with a younger team that needs to develop. Well, how are we going to know? How are we going to, maybe we'll find out in his next gig. But it blows that he doesn't get the ultimate payoff of having built that culture, built this team up to the point that Durant and Kyrie Irving wanted to join it, and then does not get to enjoy the fruits of that, of actually coaching them and contending next year. That part's a shame, but as I say, there's no fairness in the NBA. There is no deserve.
I think both of us can agree that change can be good in the coaching box. I mean,
sure.
Steve Kerr replaced Mark Jackson. That was impactful in them becoming a championship team.
Nick Nurse from Dwayne Casey.
I mean, we both love Dwayne Casey. Great guy, I think,
yes.
An excellent coach. But I don't know for sure that they win a championship without Nick Nurse coaching that team. His outside-the-box thinking was really effective for them, especially in the playoffs.
I even go back to Phil Jackson replacing Del Harris and Kurt Rambis back when
Doug
I was
Collins
covering them.
When he
replaced Doug Collins in Chicago. Like, this happens in the NBA on occasion, where there's a certain coach that can get a team just this far, and you need the next guy to get him over the hump, a different voice, a different style, a different kind of persuasiveness in the locker room, whatever it may be. And so it may well be that this turns out, I think, if like the Nets are in the finals a year from June, we're going to say, you know what, they made the right call.
I'm not sure I'd say that, though, because they'll have Durant and they'll have presumably a full Irving, and it's really not,
right, it's not a fair comparison in that case.
And, but all the guys you said, one of the biggest difference is that the coaches they replaced kind of had a body of work that the GM sort of saw. Like, even though, Dwayne Casey won Coach of the Year, but Masai Ujiri had seen a lot of how Dwayne Casey coached and just didn't believe that he was the right guy for the job. And I can respect that on a certain level. Mark Jackson had 3 years in Golden State, and some of the numbers were good, but we know what was going on behind the scenes there. A lot of locker room lawyering, a lot of toxicity within that team.
Also, the offense never achieved what it should have, given the talent that they had. They were a middle-of-the-road offense until Steve Kerr got there and changed up their offensive system.
So. Under no circumstance was Mark Jackson the right guy for that job. We just don't know with Kenny Atkinson if he could ever have evolved his system to be the coach of Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving. And look, there are some interesting telltale signs out there about who might have had an agenda. I mean, DeAndre Jordan started in the first game he played that Jacques Vaughn was the head coach, and we'd all heard the rumblings that Jordan was not happy about coming off the bench. My question about that is, like, did somebody not make it clear to DeAndre Jordan when he signed, like, all right, you're getting paid, but Jared Allen helped us get to the playoffs last year. Jared Allen is our guy.
Like, and is a better player than you right now.
Was there a miscommunication there? I mean,
how about just this? Like, you know, in politics, they talk about the optics. The optics of Jacques Vaughn deciding to start DeAndre Jordan immediately the second he replaced Kenny Atkinson. Like, guys, maybe wait a week or so, because whether that is indicative of what was going on or not, you've just now telegraphed that to the world. Everybody immediately was like, well, there it is. And whether it's true or not, you certainly have given everybody every reason in the world to believe that that is an indication of why Kenny Atkinson is out. Mm-hmm. Is that in part it was because DeAndre Jordan is boys with Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving, they're buds, and he was not happy coming off the bench, and the first thing that the interim head coach does is put him in the starting lineup. Like, seriously, consider the optics and the politics of it, and what you're messaging to, subtly or not so subtly, to the public. Wait a bit before you go and do that, because you're giving everybody reason to run with that theory now, right or wrong.
Yeah, I don't buy any idea that the team quit on Kenny. I know they had some struggles here and there, but they came back to beat Boston, down 21 the second half with Caris LeVert going bonkers. They did get blown out by Memphis, but they bounced back from that to beat a San Antonio team playing for something at that point. Those aren't hallmarks of a team that just quits on them.
No, and besides that, the Nets, while having a disappointing season overall, don't have a ton of talent. When you threw over, you know, the Ed Davises and Damari Carrolls and all these glue guys so that you could create the cap room to sign KD and Kyrie, knowing that you wouldn't have KD the whole season. And then
invested Jared Dudley, you know, part of that team last
year. So you like, and that team had overachieved last year anyway. So to come into this season with your biggest signing missing the whole season, your other biggest signing, second biggest, your 1A and Kyrie, missing most of the season and being in and out and all the ambiguities about his shoulder and all this, you shouldn't have expected all that much. So I'm not even like going to pin any struggles, losses, record, whatever. I don't even care about any of that in this case. This was a season that was never, with considering who they're missing, should never have been a high expectation season anyway. Mm. So I think as an organization, they know that. Fans can be disappointed, but the organization understands it and can take the longer view. So when you decide to make that move, it has to be because there were more fundamentally concerning things, such as if there is in fact a divide between the coach and the players, or if the locker room is drifting away, or if the stars aren't completely sold on him, whatever that combination of factors was.
So everything changes now. The Nets are no longer this kind of feel-good story that built up a great culture and added two stars, and here we go off to the races to win a championship. There's some real pressure now on everybody in that front office. By the way, before I get to the next coach, I have some questions about Joe Tsai at this point. I wrote a little bit about this earlier in the week. Like, Joe Tsai has had kind of a rocky run in his first year as an owner. It began kind of with the China stuff, where he took some positions that made you wonder about, you know, just who was he looking out for in that moment. Then David Levy, the CEO he first hires, quits after 2 months, and that was a little awkward. And I've been told, Howard, and I wrote this, that, you know, Joe maintains pretty steady communication with a lot of the top guys in that locker room. And that in and of itself is not a big deal. I mean, a lot of owners talk to a lot of players. I mean, Mark Cuban is there all the time talking to players. But if that's influencing your opinion on basketball decisions, that's a major red flag to me. Like, you, an owner, I know this happens a lot, but an owner should not be heavily involved in basketball-related decisions. Just because you're rich doesn't mean you understand the game. Like, for all of Cuban's warts as an owner and the things he says and runs his mouth, Donnie Nelson won't sit there and tell you that Mark's, you know, beyond like Giannis that year, beyond doesn't like overextend himself. You know, let's kind of Donnie do his job. Rick Carlisle's been there forever. That tells you what you need to know about how Rick feels about Mark Cuban. You've got to let your basketball people be basketball. That's the question. That's, you know, as you say, we have some questions we need answers to. I would like to know just how influential Joe Tsai was in all this, And why was he so influential? What was he getting information from players that he was then using to formulate opinions that he was then using to make impactful decisions?
Yeah, and we've all heard some of that too, right? That he was kind of making the rounds and was pulling the players, or, you know, I don't want to say polling as in literally like asking, you know, thumbs up, thumbs down, but just more surveying them and their feelings on whatever, including coach. And that's how the decision was made. We've heard that floated out there. I'm not sure how much stock I want to put in it, but I would just say that as a matter of policy, yeah, most owners don't know jack about the game and how it actually works. At the same time, it's their team, it's their investment, they can do what they want, fine. And then people will throw that out there as some blanket kind of like, well, you can't criticize them because that's their team. And they go, yeah, okay, fine. But if they want to win, if they want to have a good, healthy organization, if they want to have stability, defer to your basketball experts. First, hire really good basketball experts and then let them do their job. And what is the proper amount of distance, the proper amount of assertiveness as an owner versus being hands-off? When to get involved. All right, that's the art of it. That's the tricky part. And Josiah, like a lot of new owners, comes in and probably wants to put his own imprint on the team. And especially at the beginning, these guys, they all think they know way more than they do on day one. Now, some of them eventually figure out, I don't really know as much as I thought I did, and now I got to start to find a way to recalibrate and not be so hands-on and so meddling. Some of them never figure it out. Some of them still have not figured it out after 20 years.
Some of them are right here in New York City.
But I can think of a few others. Mm. And, you know, Josiah is going to have that same probable learning curve that the rest of them do, where he's going to come in, I don't want to say guns blazing, but he's going to come in thinking he knows it all, and I'm going to run this the same way I run my other businesses, and I'm a titan of industry, I know what I'm doing. No, you don't. You don't. This is different than anything else you could possibly run. And I'm not going to say this particular situation is a mistake. Well, that's yet to be seen. But whatever mistakes he's going to make, he's going to make them. And then eventually we'll know if he's a good owner or not based on whether or not he learns from those missteps. But everybody, they all come in thinking they've got it all figured out. And they overreach. They overmeddle. Everybody thinks it's easy. You know, guys like you and me, we covered this league for years and years, and we're networked. We think we know the game. We've seen a bazillion games. We know more than the owners do about how the NBA really works and the game, right? But if you gave me $5 billion and let me buy a team tomorrow, I would still probably F it up because it's hard. And mm-hmm. And I know more. I think I know more about how to run an NBA team than Josiah does, mm-hmm. and than most of these NBA owners do. And that's not me thinking a lot of myself or that little of them. It's just that the NBA is different than any other business. And when you're around it for a long time and you get to know GMs and coaches and scouts and players and executives and you see what works and what doesn't, that's all you and I do is talk about this stuff and talk to people who know this stuff better than we do. That's the thing. We're reporters, right? My job, I always tell people this. I'm not an expert on basketball or an expert on the NBA. My job is to talk to the experts. Mm-hmm. And then I become more informed and hopefully a little smarter about it by having those conversations. But because that's all I've done for the last 23 years of my life, I think I do have a head start on the guy who just bought a team yesterday and doesn't realize all these subtleties. And they don't take the time most of the time to get to know this stuff. So anyway, long-winded way of saying, you know, Josiah, like a lot of owners, is going to have a learning curve. And we'll see how it goes. I hope that what happened isn't just that the players did an end around and used the owner. Because that, by the way, that's a way to have an unhealthy organization. You need to have an authority structure where the front office is the final word on basketball operations. And that you trust them to make the right calls. And that you don't let the players end around the coach or end around the GM or anybody else, unless things are really, really terribly screwed up on some, you know, deep level.
So the letting go of Kenny Atkinson, it now creates probably the biggest decision the Nets have to make in the next few years. You have what will effectively be a 2 or 3 year window beginning next season to build yourself into a championship team. We look at Durant and Irving in their prime. You know, both certainly injury prone, but you know, next year is when the expectations really kick in. And that's when you need to have the right coach. Who do you think that is at this point? I mean, I heard some, I don't know who is writing it, but like the name Mark Jackson keeps popping up, and oh boy, would that be bad. Like, not good. Not the right guy for that particular job in this particular market. It just doesn't make any sense. Tom Thibodeau's out there. We both saw him this past weekend in Boston just partaking in all the festivities of Sloan. Is there a name out there that pops to you right away that you think that guy makes the most sense?
So two things on those two names. It was suggested to me in the wake of this that the Nets were trying to also get out ahead of the Knicks in the coaching search because Mark Jackson and Tom Thibodeau are guys that the Knicks may be considering too. And there's a thought that maybe they both land here, one with each team, and the Nets wanted to make sure that they got their pick. I'm not sure if I buy that, and I don't think that either Tibbs or Mark Jackson, to me, feel like a Sean Marks kind of hire.
Mark Jackson absolutely does not feel like a Sean Marks kind of hire.
And I'm not sure that Tibbs is either. But, again, is this Sean Marks making the call? Is it Josai making the call? You know, and what are they after? And I don't know what the right answer to this question is right now. I've been pondering this one, and Ty Lue's name keeps getting floated out there too. And there's some logic to that one, and people point to, well, you know, Kyrie won a championship under Ty Lue. Yeah, Kyrie also reportedly had some severe run-ins that you can find out there on the interwebs with Ty Lue. Now, a clash between star player and coach is not unusual in this league, and it also doesn't mean you can't work together again or that you don't have respect. It could happen, and I think Ty Lue can make a lot of sense. I think what they're going to need on day one is somebody who, A, commands the respect of those two stars, and B, probably has some deep postseason experience. Because if you're going to fire or push out or let go of Kenny Atkinson, who was a first-time head coach, who was known as a development coach first, you're not going to go with another like longtime assistant or another unproven. No, now you got to go for the proven quantity and the guy, because you've got... You got a window, 2-3 years maybe? How long is the window really going to be? We don't know what, I mean, we still don't even know what Kevin Durant's going to look like coming back from this Achilles. It's a serious injury. And how much he'll have to offer. We all hope that it's 100% and that it's many years to come. But we don't really know what the window is. So you don't have any cushion now. You got to get this coaching hire right, and it has to be somebody who can do it on day one and who's proven. There aren't a ton of those guys out there, but there's also going to be a whole wave of coach firings in the next couple of months. So, but no, I don't know, Chris. I don't have an answer. The who should they hire? I'm not sure.
I do think from what the people I talk to around the league think that if Sean had his druthers, Jacques Vaughn will win this job outright. You know, Jacques Vaughn seems like a Sean Marks kind of coach. You know, he's got former playing experience, obviously a former coach in Orlando with head experience. And you know, I remember, and I think I wrote this early on, when, you know, when Kenny first got the job and Jacques came in, I mean, Kenny didn't have a lot of experience running practices and doing stuff like that, so Jacques kind of took a lead role in that capacity early on in the process. So I think if Sean, my guess, and it is just a guess, if Sean had his druthers, you know, this would be a great finish to the season. I mean, they just won in L.A., you know, a nice finish there. Maybe they can squeeze out a win in a first round series, or at least be really competitive in a first round series, that Jacques Vaughn might win it. But Ty Lue makes a lot of sense for that job. But Ty's going to be in demand as well. I think Philadelphia might look at Ty Lue if they decide to part ways with Brett Brown. So yeah, it's going to be tough, but it is a critical decision that they have to make in that slot.
I think people need to dispense with the Popovich theory, by the way. I don't know where that one's coming from. Pop is either coaching in San Antonio or he's not coaching at all. Like, if he's not coaching in San Antonio, it's because he decided to retire. The idea that because of the Sean Marks connection coming from the Spurs tree and all that, that he's going to land in Brooklyn, I just don't see it at all.
No, I don't see it either. Let me finish with this. You're an official MVP voter, correct?
I mean, I have been in past years. I never want to assume that the league is sending me another ballot in a few weeks.
Well,
but yes,
as a long-time, let's call you a long-time MVP voter.
Sure, there we go.
Your mental ballot right now, is it still in flux? I don't want to, as voters, we shouldn't vote till the end of the season or announce anything.
Yeah.
But is it still in flux, or do you have a solid grip on who you might be handing that award to?
I mean, because we are all like required by law to you know, answer this question multiple times over the course of a season, right? Either by ourselves or by when we're interviewing each other or on radio or wherever. I've been saying Giannis. I've been pretty consistent with that since early in the season when they got off to this phenomenal start, and he's putting up monster numbers, and they've been on that 70-win pace, which they're no longer on. But It's been Giannis
and a lot
all
of
along.
Because Giannis went out the last couple of games,
yes.
And that might work in his favor as well.
So it's still Giannis, and LeBron is the solid number two. Can it change in the next month or so? Can LeBron overtake him? I've got some friends in the analytics community who insist no, who say no. Giannis already locked this thing up for all kinds of reasons. I don't believe anybody locks anything. And like, all right, look, Ja Morant's locked up Rookie of the Year because he's going to have played the whole season, whereas Zion's going to have played like 35 games. So that one's a lock. I have no problem saying right now Ja Morant is at the top of my ballot, and I don't see how that could possibly change. MVP, I think it's foolish to say that just because I've said Giannis in January and February and today that it's a lock. Let's see how this next month plays out. What if Giannis has to sit out the rest of the season and, God forbid, I hope that's not the case, but what if he sat out and now misses a quarter of the season? Because we all do factor in games played. If you miss too many games, most valuable player, you're less valuable when you've played fewer games. We always apply that as one of the standards. It's fair to take that into consideration if he misses a big chunk. What if he comes back, but the Bucks just meander down the stretch and the Lakers all of a sudden surpass them? I mean, for the longest time, it seemed given that the Bucks were going to win 70, which is a huge part of his MVP case, or a significant part of it, I should say, because two teams ever have won 70-plus, right? And the Lakers didn't seem like they had any chance of having best record in the league. Well, what if the Lakers end up with best record in the league? And LeBron's had the kind of season he had. And now the only knock will be, well, but he's got Anthony Davis, and there's not a single guy on the Bucks who's anywhere near Anthony Davis. With all due respect to Chris Middleton, he is not in Anthony Davis's stratosphere. And that's the biggest hindrance for LeBron, is that the Lakers' record, their success, has so much to do with LeBron having Anthony Davis as his number two. That said, LeBron is the entire engine of that team. All that preseason talk about it's Anthony Davis' time, I'm going to defer to him, but bullshit. Mm-hmm. LeBron's averaging a career high in assists. He's leading the league in assists per game. He is the engine of everything that they do. He's the reason they are great. He is still playing at an MVP level. I don't believe in this whole grading on the curve because it's year 17 and age 35. Like, I don't care, but you cannot factor in age in an MVP argument. That's dumb. It's impressive. It's what makes his season even more impressive. But it's not why he's better than Giannis for MVP. So I don't consider that as a factor. But LeBron's numbers alone and the Lakers winning, those are the factors that matter. And Giannis doesn't have that big of a lead on him statistically, I don't think. And LeBron is still the more complete all-around player. And I've said this many times, too. I'll end on this point. If I had to win a best-of-seven series that started tomorrow, I'm still picking LeBron over Giannis, over Kawhi, over anyone else. Now, does that mean he should win MVP? Not necessarily. It's still about the body of work for this season. But I still think he's the best player in the league.
Yeah, you made a lot of my arguments. I give... Giannis is putting up numbers that we haven't seen since Shaq in early 2000. Like, and when Shaq was at his peak. You know, the 30 points per game, the 13, 14 rebounds per game. He's probably... He's certainly one of, not the best defensive player in basketball. The argument for LeBron being the MVP, to me, is that his defense has been great this year too. Mm-hmm. Whereas you and I both know in years past, indifferent might be the best way to describe him during the regular season. And that matters. Like, you can put up great offensive numbers, but if you're a one-way player, or at least a one-way player for 75% of every game, you lose something off that boat. So he's closed the gap considerably, in my opinion. And if this knee injury for Giannis does turn out to cost him, you know, more than just a couple of games, it looks like it's going to cost him, then I'd have to reevaluate. But right now, I feel the same way. It's like Giannis by like a head at the moment. It's like a horse race. You're just a little bit ahead at the moment, and it's really tough for LeBron without something happening to the guy next to you to win the whole thing. I mean, the Bucks. Look, I don't think you can underrate the Anthony Davis factor either. I mean, like, Davis is having an MVP-like season himself. Like, LeBron is still the man, but Davis has been great all season long. He might be Defensive Player of the Year this year. He has been the same Anthony Davis we're used to seeing, and Chris Middleton's not that guy. Now, the Bucks are deeper, 3-7. They're probably better.
Agreed.
But I think the number two really matters in most situations. Talent rises to the top.
It does. The tricky thing for us in the MVP voting every year and in these discussions is how much you factor in teammates, right? So Russ won, and I disagreed with it. I voted Harden that year, but Russ won largely based on this perception that, well, his supporting cast blows, so look at what he's done, and they made the playoffs as a sixth seed. But the lack of supporting cast worked in his favor. Giannis is also going to have similarly, supporting cast is better than that, but he's going to have a similar kind of framework for his MVP case, which is they're going to win 65, 67 games, whatever it's going to be, 68 games, and it's almost entirely because of him. There is no number two, no true number two, not in the same way of like LeBron and Dwayne Wade or Shaq and Kobe or Scotty and Michael or whoever. And LeBron is going to have the almost the deficit of Anthony Davis. It could hurt his MVP argument. The flip side of that is you don't want to punish a guy for being on a great team, but look, there's a reason why Steph Curry and Kevin Durant weren't getting a lot of MVP run the last few years, despite them being in the finals every year, because, well, they're great because of both of them. How do you parse that out? And there's a reason why Shaq only won one MVP in all those years he was with Kobe, and Kobe only won one, and it was after Shaq was gone. Because these guys were offsetting each other, and it's hard to decide, well, it's because of that one guy. And so when we think about who we're more impressed by, who's more valuable, it's usually the guy who had less help around him, so he had to do more work. That's just the way these discussions have always kind of gone. And so I'm cognizant of that, but I don't want to, like I say, I don't want to punish LeBron for having Anthony Davis, but there is something more impressive about uplifting a team that doesn't have an Anthony Davis. Like, it's just in there. I think the other interesting part about this, actually, Chris, is the 3-4-5. Like, no one's going to care about that part of it, but the 3-4-5, I think, is actually really interesting. We had Siakam for a while, Luka, Harden, Chris Paul is now deservedly getting some consideration.
I don't even know what three is at this point. Like, for a while it was Harden, but they've gone into the crapper as of late, and it's extending.
In December, it was Siakam.
Yeah.
I think, if I'm remembering my
November,
timeline
December,
correctly.
November, December, it was right around there.
In January, I think it was Luka, you know. So the 3-4-5, right, these are not
Tatum.
Guys.
Tatum at this point.
Tatum, why not?
Put Tatum in the mix.
There are other guys, that's going to be interesting. That'll only be interesting for posterity and for, you know, how the ultimate ballot pans out so we can see who went 3-4-5-6-7-8 when all is said and done, all is counted. I think the vast majority of voters are going to have Giannis and LeBron in the two top spots in one order or the other. And I think Giannis is probably going to win, but we've got a month to go.
Yeah, should be interesting. Howard, always appreciate it, man.
Always fun.
Stay out of potentially hazardous situations. I don't even know what that looks like anymore. You've got a family. You don't know where your kids are running around, your wife is running around at, who they're shaking hands with. It's like,
every day we're just taking our lives in our hands. But, you know, this is New York. We've always just taken our lives in our hands.
But, see, I live alone in Boston, so I'm just going to quarantine myself.
You're already a hermit.
I'm going to order pizza every day.
Right.
This is great.
Right.
Watch League Pass.
Chris Mannix being on sequester is, like, no different than, like, 90% of your day.
No different. You could also, the NBA could have some, I don't want to call it fun because it's not fun, but, like, if they had to do something in L.A., like, how about the Lakers play at, like, the Mamba Academy for, like, games? Like, just, like, kind of do something unique. Don't play in your empty arena.
The Lakers have, I think his name is Steve Jackson, who's the season ticket holder, who's very wealthy, who made a replica of Staples Center that a lot of teams practice at his estate. Let's just go play at Steve Jackson's house. I hope I'm getting the name right, if I'm remembering this all correctly.
Or Jimmy Goldstein's got the blue court from Space Jam. You can do that.
Let's just have the NBA go on tour of all the rich season ticket holders who have built replica courts.
You could actually, I mean, it wouldn't be ideal, but you could. It's better than playing in an empty Staples or an empty Madison Square Garden or an empty Boston Garden.
Because that'll just be weird. It'll just feel like a ghost town. It doesn't matter what else they do to try to create environment. Remember when the Knicks actually decided to have I think it was just a single half, and it was the Knicks against the Warriors a couple years ago where they had a throwback like the games used to sound like, so there was no piped-in noise.
Mm-hmm. I remember that.
And afterward, all the players were like, yeah, that was freaking weird, man. Like, that was unsettling. Like, it's... And I had David Thorpe on my podcast yesterday. He's saying, listen, all these guys have played in front of almost empty or in empty gyms at some point as kids. Like, it won't be that different. I'm like, eh, but... Since then, they've been playing in nothing but packed places. Like, LeBron, even when he was a kid, was playing in packed gyms. So if the only sound you hear after you score is your own teammates clapping, that's going to be strange.
Or a broadcaster saying, oh, that was a
right. Can you imagine?
Analysis.
The players are going to actually be able to hear everything that's being said at the on the sideline, and they're going to be like looking, they're going to be like staring down the broadcaster like, hey, F you. Like that was,
or your own coach, the equivalent of can't play canter. You're like, oh boy, what the fuck? You suck.
Chris, we are going to hear everything.
Which has a little bit of appeal. Howard, appreciate it. Elbow bump on the way out. Thanks, man.
Thank you.